Sure.
Todd, thank you so much for joining us. This was a talk that a lot of group members had interest in and was, explicitly requested by multiple people in the seminar group, which really just speaks to the incredibly niche interests of people in the Boston Computation Club. But I'm really excited about it. I'm really glad you're able to join us today. And with that, I'll just let you take it away. So thank you so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to this.
Sure. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're so interested. This is like my favorite topic in computer science. So, no, thanks for calling it niche. That's good. My name is Todd Schmidt. I'm currently a professor at St. Mary's College of California, an assistant professor. And I'm going to be talking about how to write a co-equation, which is based on a Calco Perl, which I wrote with Fred Dahlquist, who's now at Queen Mary University of London, although I think we were both at UCL at the time of writing this. So, how to write a co-equation? I'm rolling up my sleeves now because there's a whole bunch of stuff we got to get into. First thing that I'm going to write down here is the word is just like I'm going to circle this if I can figure out how to use this. Let's do it. Ooh, I'm drawing. All right. The word co. Look, if I get rid of this, we're left with equation, right? And when I use CO and I put that in front, that means that we're going to be dualizing something. And in this case, we're going to be dualizing equations. Okay. Dualizing things is a very categorical. So dualizing. Let's see if I can use this pen. Dualizing things. Entails interpreting them in a category. So I'm going to start by basically interpreting equations and giving a sort of equivalent description of equations in very categorical terms. And then once we've done that, we can go back to this slide, and then we can erase this box I've drawn over co, and we can actually talk about co-equations, which are intended to be the dual of equations. So let's talk about equations a little bit. I mean, we've all seen them before. I've written this equation over here a little bit abstractly, but it should be more or less familiar. If you write things like, here x1 times x2 times x3 equals x1 times x2 times x3. I mean, this is just sort of a more concrete version of what I've written below. And this is exactly how you should interpret equations. So, on the left and right-hand side of an equation in algebra is just a sort of term. Two terms that are built out of some variables. So I've got variables from some set X here. And each of these T1 and T2 are terms built out of some algebraic signature. Here I've written sigma. Sigma can have things like multiplication, maybe plus. Okay, let me try this again. Okay, multiplication or plus or like, I don't know, sequential composition of programs. This is like where computer science, I guess, kind of enters the picture. Or other things like the Kleene star, another great example of a kind of thing that can appear in an algebraic signature. But the point is that we want to be able to write down equations between terms and talk about the algebras that satisfy those equations. Okay, but I need to tell you a little bit about terms and how we construct the terms categorically. So let's start there. So the terms will come from, well, I've written a sigma equation in X variables. This is maybe how I'm going to refer to this kind of equation. Okay, but the terms come from, okay, well, the terms give us an adjunction, and this is really how to talk about free algebras. So this right here, this is a functor which takes in any set and builds the terms in signature sigma in variables from X. And this construction of taking a set of variables and building all the terms gives us a left adjoint to taking any algebra, say like this, in that signature, and just forgetting about the algebraic operations and just looking at this underlying set. So yeah, so I guess the abstract way to describe this is that this T sigma is a left adjoint to this forgetful functor. Now, what that really means is that if I start with a function from X, which we're interpreting as our set of variables, into an algebra, so this Y, I'm kind of assuming it comes with an algebraic structure, some way of using these algebraic operations from sigma to build new things out of old things. So if I start with a function from the variables into Y, if I interpret the variables as elements of Y, then I get a unique way of extending that function to a function from the terms, not just a function, but an algebraic, a sigma algebra homomorphism from the terms to the algebra. And this basically just involves building the terms inductively and then evaluating them in the algebra. And I'll write this as like an H with a hash. So what the adjunction is saying is that if we're given a function from a set of variables to an algebra, y alpha y, right here, we're starting with this data, then we get a unique extension, a unique algebraic, a unique homomorphic extension of that map to the terms. And that the extension property just means that this little triangle down here commutes. So I guess a classic example of this is the example of monoids. So terms in this case are going to just be things like this. So our signature has a multiplication, it's a binary operation. And we have one constant, which is just the unit. And we can build terms by just multiplying things, which might involve the constant, it might not. And here, these are variables from some set, like this, from some set, which I put here. So these are sort of typical elements of your T sigma of x1, x2, x3. Okay, but monoids are not just the signature, and they're not just the terms. And this universal property is nice, but I mean, this is not the whole story. Really, what defines a monoid is that it satisfies these three equations down here. And okay, so if we wanted to build the free algebra from a signature, no equations at all, then we can just build the terms. But if we wanted to build the free monoid, one way to do it would be to take the terms and then impose the equations afterwards. And I'll mention this again, but we're talking about all this because we're trying to sort of categorify this picture. Imposing the equations involves taking a quotient of some sort, basically identifying some things. And interpreting equations very literally, so we're trying to dualize equations. So to interpret equations very literally, we can see them like this. So an equation, it has a left-hand side and a right-hand side. That's why I've written these things right here. If we just take our set E over here and we say, just write the first one as 0, the second one is 1, the third one is 2, then capturing the first equation, we might just write that L of 0 is equal to x1 dot x2 dot x3. And r of 0 equals x1 dot x2 dot x3. So interpreting equations very literally, I'm just interpreting them as a pair of maps from some set of indices over the equations we're trying to capture. And imposing this equation, this particular equation, 0, or imposing this particular set of equations, 0, 1, and 2, I'm just going to take a co-equalizer. So I'm going to go, look, the pairs of terms that lie on either side of one of these equations, I basically want to see them as the same. And so we're just going to sort of impose this identity for each of these equations among the terms. And we're going to get some set Q. I've called it Q for co-equalizer, even though I know it's a Q and not a C. And Q is just, you know, the set of terms modulo this equivalence. Okay, this already gives us a very nice way of characterizing monoids. We have the equations that we want over here. We have some set over here, which is our terms modulo equations, and we have this quotient map. So we can even say that an algebra, a monoid, is any algebra, let's say, I think I was calling them Y before. So an algebra is just a pair set in an interpretation of the operations. And an algebra is going to satisfy these equations, i.e., it's going to be a monoid, if for any interpretation of the variables, that unique extension to a homomorphism on terms is going to factor through this co-equalizer. So no matter how we interpret the variables, this, you know, the unique algebra homomorphism that extends that interpretation is going to identify these pairs of equations. Oh, I mean, that's exactly what we wanted to begin with. Okay, you have to be a little bit careful if this is your approach to constructing the free monoid, because all we've done is identify these particular pairs of terms. So for example, we haven't, in Q, we haven't identified, for example, x2 dot x1 dot x3 and x2 dot x1 dot x3. That's still not identified by this co-equalizer, which it is, you know, we haven't quite achieved that goal, but thankfully that's not our end goal. The point was that we wanted a characterization of monoids in terms of a co-equalizer, something categorical. Right. Okay, so an algebra satisfies the equations of E if every homomorphic lifting of a variable assignment factors through this quotient. Okay, so yes, you have to be a little bit careful. This Q is not going to carry an algebra structure that satisfies E. What we have to do if we want, if we actually want an algebra structure out of this co-equalizer, is we have to require something slightly more of our equations. So we should close our equations under, you know, the usual rules that you would want an algebraic equivalence to satisfy, and we call these algebraic equivalences congruences. So if we further impose this restriction on the equivalence, maybe we just close E under this rule. Then we get an actual algebraic quotient, and not just this, well, very nice but a little bit oversimplified description of monoids. So doing this, we get a very general notion of equational theory and satisfaction of an equational theory. So because every congruence, so if I start with a congruence here, So an equivalence, which is closed under the algebraic constructions. Oh, I think I got a raised hand.
Yeah, I had a question. In the previous slide, there was a sigma. What was that?
Sigma. Oh, yeah. Okay. So this sigma right here, this sigma is just in the signature. So maybe I'll zoom in on this for a second.
Yeah. Could you explain this part?
Yeah. So you want to imagine you're given a bunch of terms. And actually the monoid case helps a lot. So let me maybe start with that. So suppose you're given two terms, T1 of X, and let's say T1, and T1 is equivalent to S1. Oh my goodness. Equivalent to S1 of X, and T2 of X is equivalent to S2 of X. So for monoids, if you have both of these pairs of equivalences, T1 is equivalent to S1 and T2 is equivalent to S2, then you should also know that T1 dot T2 is equivalent to S1 dot S2. So all this is saying is that if you have some equivalences between terms, and then you use those terms in an algebraic construction, then you retain
sigma
equivalence.
Basically creating a term out of T1 to TN.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So sigma is just an algebraic operation, and these are the sort of inputs to this algebraic operation. Yeah.
Thanks.
Right. So this closure under congruence is really what we need in order to actually give Q an algebra structure, which is why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
But we need to give it an algebra structure. But thankfully, if we do this in advance, if we make sure that E is closed under this congruence rule, then what we obtain is a very nice characterization of satisfaction of an equational theory. So this T sigma X here, this is a sigma algebra. And this is also a sigma algebra. And this quotient that I've written here, this Q, is actually an algebraic quotient. If we can make sure that this equivalence relation that we've got is a congruence. So every congruence gives rise to a quotient algebra.
When you say algebra is without equational rules.
Yeah, this is without equational rules. So T sigma X is a sigma algebra that doesn't necessarily satisfy these equations, right? Or it if the set of equations is empty, then it does. But in any other situation, it's not going to. It's just all of the terms, right? And then this Q alpha Q, this is an algebra now that's going to satisfy these particular equations, which I've written, I guess, in the monoids example, these particular equations. Now, I could get into like how to close the equations under more operations so that you don't have this problem still. I need to scroll up. So you don't have this problem still where, like, because even in the algebra below, Q is still actually not going to satisfy this equation. But I'm going to say we don't care about that for now. Basically, I just want a nice description of satisfaction of an equational theory. And look, this still works. So if I start with a quotient, an algebraic quotient like this, taking a homomorphism, the image of an algebra homomorphism, then the same thing still applies. The same definition still applies. Basically, an algebra Y alpha satisfies this. Satisfies this equational theory, which I've written with a tilde here, if for any homomorphism from the terms, which are each given by a variable assignment. So you could think of this as being like for any variable assignment, this variable assignment factors through the quotient algebra. And this characterization of equational satisfaction still holds. I mean, this is the same thing still. Okay, so every congruence gives rise to a picture like this, where we have an algebraic quotient, and satisfaction of the equations is characterized by factorizing through this quotient. Conversely, if you start with a quotient, an algebraic quotient, you can also get a congruence back. And you can do this by taking the kernel of your quotient map. So this right here, this is the set of all pairs, let's say T1, T2, or I was using S before, so I'll just use T and S. Terms, T and S, such that Q of T equals, oh my goodness, equals Q of S, like that. So you can take the kernel of this quotient and get back the very literal interpretation of an equational theory that you had before. So basically what I'm saying is we can think of an equational theory as just being a quotient of the term algebra, of the free algebra on some set of variables. That's really the same thing as an equational theory. And what else have I written here? Oh yeah, what's nice about this picture is that the algebraic quotients picture is very easy to dualize, right? Because I mean, when we think of dualizing things in categories, it's just, well, turn all the arrows around. It's slightly more complicated than that. This is a quotient, and I guess in category theory, you'd say that this is like an epi arrow. I have to be a little bit careful. It's more than an epi. I'm actually requiring that it's a surjective algebra homomorphism. Does anyone have any idea what the dual of a surjective algebra homomorphism in one direction would be? Wait, I heard multiple people speak at once. I think Max said I have no clue.
An injective algebra homomorphism?
Yeah. So,
or cool algebra.
So we'll talk about coalgebra in a second. But basically, when we dualize this, this is going to go from being an algebraic quotient in one direction to being a coalgebra injection in the other direction. And so this is where we're going. But there's kind of a step in between. I have to tell you what a coalgebra is first before we can really make sense of this dualization process. So algebras, so if I do my coloring in trick here, algebras are really pairs that consist of a set and a sort of a structure map that takes us from, I guess you could say, computations of type sigma in the variables and applies algebraic operators and gives you back elements of that set. So algebras go in one direction. So this sigma here basically builds all of the different possible things that you could interpret as elements of X algebraically. And the alpha X actually does that interpretation. So for example, for monoids, sigma is just, I guess, X squared for the multiplication and then one for the constant. And this alpha tells you how to interpret the constant and how to do the multiplication. Flipping this around, you get a picture like this, where instead of the type of computation being on the left, the type of computation appears on the right. So here I get to erase my scribbling. Okay, we'll talk about the example in a second, but I get to erase my scribbling and I get to say, okay, so coalgebras are parameterized. So types of coalgebras are parameterized not by signatures in the classic universal algebra sense, but by sort of more general functors. And today I'm going to kind of be focusing on functors that take sets to sets. Just that makes things a lot simpler. And a coalgebra for one of these functors from sets to sets is a structure that consists of a set of states and a map, which you can think of in all sorts of different ways, as a transition map, as a structure map, as a deconstructor map, as some people call them, that just takes each state to some computation of type B over the variables X. And a homomorphism of coalgebras is, it actually flips the homomorphism of algebra's picture around. So another way to characterize homomorphisms of algebras, if you're given two algebras over X, let's say this is alpha X, alpha Y. Whoa. This is one characterization that you can have of homomorphisms, where you can think of, say, X1 dot X2 as being a pair, which you interpret with alpha X. And then you just get X1 dot X2, I suppose. And then you can map with H. So this will give you H, X1 dot X2. And then if you follow sigma around, this is a functor. So this is going, you're going to apply H to sigma of H. You're going to apply H to each component. So it's going to give you H of X1 and then H of X2, which you interpret with alpha Y, which is going to be H of X1 dot H of X2. And the homomorphism condition tells you that these things are equivalent. For coalgebras, we just flip this around. We, instead of putting the computation type on the left, we put it on the right. And this is this captures and unifies many things in many different examples. So there's like so many examples, but here are some that you're probably familiar with. So you can think of deterministic automata as being coalgebras of this type, two times and then something, and then with some input letters A. Label transition systems, where here I've written L for the labels. Mealy machines, labeled Markov chains, Markov decision processes. And I could literally go on all day about this, but I'm not going to. So not only do we have all these examples of coalgebras, but the notion of coalgebra homomorphism actually captures all the different notions of homomorphism that have appeared in the literature for these different machines. So you have things like input-output matching for Mealy machines, preservation of language acceptance for deterministic automata, and bisimilarity, which is like way more general, but you're probably familiar with it, label transition systems. So preserving these kinds of behavioral characteristics of the coalgebra is exactly what this notion of homomorphism is trying to capture, and it does in many cases.
Does this also capture like notions of bisimulation refinement, stuff like that?
So you have to be careful. So bisimulation refinement, as in you're constructing a bisimulation, like in a stepwise.
For example, if I have two machines and I want to show this is stuttering bisimulation, so if I kind of ignore the next operator, they like behave equivalently, you know, modulo some details and maybe don't care about. We do this sort of thing a lot when we're trying to show that like two implementations of some spec achieve the same goal, right? In formal methods. I'm wondering.
So there's like a whole body of literature, a whole research program on like capturing all these different notions of behavioral equivalence coalgebraically like this. It's not, so you have to basically change the category of sets to other categories. You have to add structure. Set, it has no structure. So you always have to add structure, but just deciding what structure to add actually is like, that's a whole line of research on its own. So I know people have done this with like branching by simulation. It involves a lot of like graded monads, if you've seen those before. So anyways, the answer is yes, but not really in the category of sets. We're talking about like a slightly simplified situation just because coequations are hard. Okay. So what was I saying? Okay. So we have coalgebras now, and they capture all these examples. They seem to be a simple dualization of algebras, like we were talking about before. We had equations. So how do we take those? And we even have like a nice categorical description of equations. Now it's time for us to describe the dual concept for coalgebras. So in order for us to do this, we not only have to flip this arrow around and talk about an injection instead of a quotient, but we also have to figure out what to do with the term algebra, which played an important role in interpreting equations. So dual to the situation in algebra, where we have this term construction, which is left adjoint to the, forget the algebraic operations functor, we have a different injunction, which constructs not the free algebra or the term algebra, but constructs the co-free co-algebra. And sometimes you see this called the co-term construction. And instead of the co-term construction being left adjoint, now it's right adjoint to the forgetful functor. So to write this in a line, we have that now the forgetful functor is actually the left adjoint instead of being the right adjoint, like in algebra. Okay, I've put this the ominous under weak conditions on B for all of the examples that I talked about. Relation, this adjunction exists. So let's just sort of pretend for the sake of this talk that this adjunction always exists, even though there are very interesting cases where it doesn't. Anyways, so we also have to dualize the term construction to get this co-term or co-free coalgebra construction. All right, so we've dualized the term construction, and this gives us our like quickest, like dirtiest description of what a coequation is. And it's also a very general notion of coequation. So instead of taking a quotient of algebras, we look at a sub coalgebra of a co-free coalgebra. And there's some terminology here that I'm going to start using. So this co-free coalgebra, this is the co-free coalgebra in X colors. So X is a set of, and then quote unquote, colors. And it'll become very clear why we call them colors after I say sort of the following two sentences. The intuition behind terms is that they're finite trees. They're like syntax trees, right? If that's like a good intuition for you, then you can think of coterms as being finite or infinite, like potentially infinite syntax trees. Now, in a syntax tree, the variables appear as the leaves, right? What are dual to the sort of leaves of a tree? Well, they're the interior nodes of a tree. So instead of labeling the leaves with variables, we label the interior nodes of our infinite trees. And this is what Jan Rutten called coloring the nodes. So we've stuck with this. we're stuck with this now. I think it's inspired by like red-black trees or something. I think that's I don't
But
know about you.
it's basically predicates, right? You're coming up with predicates to simplify kind of your view of the tree, of the terms.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can think of each color as being a different predicate on the nodes in the tree. That's a very good way of looking at it.
So instead of variables, we are focusing on functions or predicates, because variables will not occur within the tree in a co-inductive tree.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, the variables very well, there may not be any leaves at all. So yeah, we're definitely focusing on the nodes, the interior nodes of the tree. And yeah, we give them colors so that so this brings us to the notion of satisfaction. If you're given a coequation in X colors, a given coalgebra, say Y beta Y down here, is going to satisfy this coequation if for any coloring of the states of that coalgebra, the unique, so this is given by a coloring, so you can go from Y to X. This is going to give you a unique lifting of this coloring function just by the sort of right adjoint property. A coalgebra homomorphism into the cofree coalgebra. So what this is saying is that for any different way of coloring the states of your coalgebra, the lifted sort of unraveling of that coalgebra is going to factor through your coequation, which is a predicate basically on these patterns in the color X, in the colors from X. Okay, so there's a slogan that comes along with this. Just to go back to this picture, the colorings unraveling are like unraveling these infinite trees based on your automaton, your label transition system, or whatever you have on your hands. And the satisfaction just says that that tree that you've got is inside your coequation. So the slogan is basically that an equational theory imposes conditions on a free algebra, whereas a coequation requires conditions on behavior. And this is like how the satisfaction works out. Okay. So I guess one way that you could summarize Fred and I's tutorial on coequations is that it's just an overview of all of the really nice and smart ways to specify subcoalgebras of a cofree coalgebra. That's really what we were talking about. We're just talking about different ways in which you can actually specify these subsets. These subsets of trees, even. Before I'm going to finish with a couple of examples, maybe two or three examples, depending on how much time we have. But I need to mention, if I bring up coequations and equations, I mean, I need to bring up this pair of results. The first one is very old, from the 30s, and it was kind of what it's one of the main reasons why we care about equations. Is that the category of algebras that satisfy a given set of equations is a variety. It's a very nicely structured category that we can do all sorts of nice things with. We can take homomorphic images of an algebra that satisfies some equations, and we know that it's still going to satisfy those equations. We can take, I wrote sub-coalgebras here because I have a bad copy and paste job, but I really meant sub-algebras. We can take a subalgebra of an algebra that satisfies some equations. We still know that it's going to satisfy those equations. And we can take products as well. For coalgebras, I mean, we get the dual result. And this is proved I've written a bunch of names here, but in all sorts of levels of generality, mostly more or less starting with Rutan. Relaxing restrictions step by step. for coalgebras, we know that a given category of coalgebras is closed under homomorphic images, subcoalgebras, and coproducts, if and only if there's some coequation that describes them. And there's some really nice open, there's a really nice open problem that I hope that I will get to by the end, where we have a really nice description of a, I'll just put the terminology on the screen. We have a really nice description of a covariety, one that's closed under the homomorphic images and subcoalgebras and coproducts I've written here, but we actually don't have a coequation for it. And we don't know how many colors you need even to describe this coequation. We know it has to be more than one color, but we don't know how many colors. Okay, I'm gonna try to get to that at the end.
Do you have any examples that, do you know anything that requires like more than finite colors?
Yes. Yes, for sure. Let's see. Did I put it in my notes? Maybe. I can tell you in advance. So I have a slide here where I've just sort of written down some different properties which you can determine using coequations, but you can't determine using coequations. The blue and green in the bottom right here, these are all properties that you can characterize using coequations. And you'll notice that there's a couple of these. There's local finiteness, and there is a topology. So local finiteness actually takes infinitely many colors. It takes like one color for each natural number to characterize. But there are some, I mean, I really like the examples which are just like, oh, it takes three colors and not two. And actually understanding those examples is not easy. And I'd love to see a lot more of it. There's like not enough research in that area. Okay.
God, I missed something very, very basic. Can colors overlap with one another and contain one another? Like what relationships, or are they totally disjoint?
So they're colorings of the states. So I have a bunch of blank space down here. I'm just gonna move down. So let me actually tell you about colorings. This is a good idea. So if you're given a coalgebra, let's say this, what I mean by a coloring is I literally mean just any function into your set of colors. And I've already chosen X from the name of my coalgebra. Maybe the colors can be Y. That's fine. This is going to be my set of colors. So this right here, which we'll call C, this is the coloring right here. So the coloring is really a partition of your states. The colors can't overlap. You can't have two states, or you can't have one state with two different colors.
But I can just come up with multiple colorings to capture the different aspects of the problem I'm interested in, and then reason about them in that way.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So given one of these colorings, because of the adjoint condition, we get a unique lifting to a coalgebra, which I'll just write like this, the cofree coalgebra. I use zeta because, so this coloring lifting to unique coalgebra homomorphism is really the same as saying, so this is the same picture as saying that here is me packaging the coloring up with the coalgebra homomorphism, or with the coalgebra structure. It's just saying that C B Y here. Oh my goodness. Sorry, this should have been a Y. Cofree coalgebra for the augmented structure Y times B. They're the sort of augmented functor Y times B. like that. Yeah, so it's really like a final coalgebra thing, is this these like colorings. Okay, I should also draw in this arrow here. Each coterm in the co-free coalgebra on Y colors has a color. It's the color of the root. Okay, so I've said that the co-free coalgebra is really a final coalgebra. You've probably heard of a different final coalgebras, or at least you've heard like those words said before. So we're going to sort of talk about those. And the next couple of things that I say don't like terribly surprise you with this image in mind. Okay, so I wanted to go over some examples of co-equations and just sort of give you like a sense for what kind of things they can be. My first example, I wanted to talk about deterministic automata. So a deterministic automaton is, I mean, you can characterize it as a coalgebra of the form, so as a map form x to 2 times x to the A, where A is some set of labels. So that is a B coalgebra where B is 2 times, you know, whatever the input is, to the A. And this to the A are maps from A in. And I guess I'll write this down. 2 is just the set of X, and this is supposed to be a check mark. So it's like thumbs down emoji, thumbs up emoji. If I were better at drawing that, I would draw that. Just some sort of graphical notation. I'm going to write that sort of X makes a transition to Y. I'm going to draw this if we look at the transition X A, we're going to get hold on a second. So if we look at the outgoing transitions of X, this is going to be a pair which consists of a thumbs down emoji and just a map, which I'm going to write as like partial X like this, and partial X, if we take the A derivative of X, we're going to land on the state Y. This is like some sort of graphical notation I'm going to use. And if I write X with two circles around it, but you know, same transition. So this means the same thing. So if I look at X, I'm going to get thumbs down emoji and partial, or wait, hold on. No, the difference between these is that this is going to get thumbs up emoji. All right, my bad. The partial A X is now Y. So the two circles just means that X is accepting. Okay. The co-free, so the co-free two times, so the co-free deterministic automaton on X colors is the set of infinite A branching trees. Labeled by colors in X, as well as, you know, these thumbs down, thumbs up emojis, which I'm writing X and check mark. Okay, and if you look at one of these, it looks something like this. So this first node might be x1. And this x1 here, this is the color of this node. And there's going to be an outgoing parent-child relationship for each one of the letters in A. So here's, let's call this x2, x3. And each of these is going to have a1 down to an. A1 down to AN, and so on and so forth. They're infinite trees. And in particular, so if you look specifically at C1, the Cauchy algebra on one color. This is actually isomorphic to just the classic languages with the Berezovsky derivative. So this here is Berezovsky derivative. Okay, and I mean, what this means is that a coequation in one color is a subset, let's call it V, CV1, which is the same as being a subset here. So this is, so coequation one color is a set of languages. Can anyone guess what satisfaction should be? When does a deterministic automaton satisfy a coequation in one color?
It accepts.
It accepts.
It accepts everything. All strings.
So a coequation just needs to factor through the subset, right? So, but yes, so it's going to accept languages. But more specifically, it's, so every state except a language in the coequation. Yeah, okay, does that make sense?
So you have sort of like a machine full of machines. Is that a ridiculous way to put this, or is that accurate?
It's not really a machine full of machines, but I see what you're saying. So it's a little bit like these are like the possible runs of a machine.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, and so your machine satisfies the coequation if you run the machine and you get one of the runs in the coequation.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So a coequation. So this is general now. In general, a coequation in one color is a behavioral coequation. Because it's just the behavior of my machine is one of these behaviors. That's it. It's not more complicated than that. The limitations of behavioral coequations are basically that they can't talk about states. So I had this picture up here where down in the right-hand corner, I wrote behavioral properties. What I mean by properties you can characterize with the behavioral coequation. And accepting a certain language or accepting one of a set of languages is one of these. Okay, so I have like a trick question for you. A question. I'm
so,
already
sorry.
Telling you to, yeah.
So if the coequation only have one color, how does it show on the tree that you draw on the left? Isn't like, so everything should have the same color? Is it, every node has the same color? Is it the same?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Every node has the same color, or you know, no colors at all, really. So you could erase all of these colors, and what you end up with is basically just a tree where some states accept, some don't. That tells you whether or not a certain path is accepted, which is the same thing as like a predicate on your words. Yeah.
So wait, you said that the coloring is surjective, right?
So
like nothing. Oh, but then things could be uncolored, which means that one color is really kind of like two, right?
Oh,
because you could just
sorry.
not
So
bother to color something.
Coloring is a total function. It is a function on all of the states.
I see. I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And if you think about coloring, like a coloring of the nodes of a tree, the nodes are sort of mirror images of states.
Yes,
in some
I was viewing the coloring backwards in my head for some reason, but what you're saying makes sense. Yeah,
in that sense, yeah, it is reductive. Okay, good.
It seems to me like at least in most cases, coefficients in one color is exactly isomorphic to the co-free coalgebra.
So there's yes, but final coalgebra, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so coequation in one color is so the co-free coalgebra in one color. This is always the final coalgebra.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This.
A little bit of question about final coalgebra versus co-free coalgebra. It seems like this is. Oh, never mind. I'm stupid. Please.
I disagree with that. Well, one product, anything is just isomorphic to the thing that you're taking the product with.
Yeah.
So this is like in one color, this is the final color.
Yeah, I see. Thank you.
Okay. So here's my trick question. Which deterministic automata, which deterministic automata satisfy the coequation consisting of all regular languages? So which are these ones?
He's our resident language theorist, so I'm going to defer to him.
Remember, languages are like states in a co-free coalgebra over one color.
So what does this question mean? Isn't like one coequation identify a particular regular language?
So a coequation for deterministic automata.
Oh, I don't set. Oh,
yeah, it's going to be a subset of languages. It's going to be a set of languages. Yeah. So regular languages is a set of languages, right? So it's a co-equation.
So isn't like all deterministic automata satisfy this co-equation? Because all of them accept some regular languages.
Even infinite ones?
Finite ones, yes.
So DFAs definitely satisfy. DFAs are included for sure. Are there any infinite ones that satisfy this?
Well, if the infinite ones are bisimilar to, they have a homomorphism to a finite one, then you can do that.
So no, very, very good, Chung. You've answered my question. So we're always used to seeing that a deterministic automaton when it satisfies a regular language, it's because it's finite, right? But that's of course not always the case. We can just be bisimilar to one. So let me write this down here. Answer, do a chunk, bisimilar to a DFA. To a finite one. Good stuff. Okay. I'm over time, actually. Do you want me to keep going?
I think if you want to keep going for another 15, 20 minutes, it's totally fine. But we may start losing members if people have to go to other obligations.
Okay.
I have to head out now. So, thanks for the great talk, Todd.
You're very welcome. Yeah, thank you for coming. Yeah, I mean, I know it's like Saturday evening. The only other one that I really wanted to talk about was if you'll entertain me, or you'll indulge me, I wanted to talk about a co-equation on deterministic automata that is not behavioral, but is nevertheless very interesting. So here's maybe my second example. Also for deterministic automata. So I want to give, so consider the following. Two color property. So this is, you want to fix two words, W and U. And we're going to set, so the property is going to be the set of all trees. Whoops. In two colors, such that the color, if you follow the tree down one way, is the same as the color if you follow the tree down the other way. BA. Then if you follow these two down, then their colors have to be the same. Like that. So I guess my question for you, if you want to think about it for a second, would be which deterministic automata satisfy this two-color property?
Is it all the accepting state has the same color?
All the accepting states have the same color.
I don't think that's correct. Sorry.
So remember, so a coalgebra satisfies a coequation if for any coloring, when you unravel, it satisfies the property describing the coequation. So in this case, the property is that if you follow the unraveling down two steps, one AB and the other one BA, then the nodes of the tree that you arrive at are going to be the same color.
Is it fair to call this like a commutative property?
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of a commutative property, isn't it? Part of why I chose it for Chung.
Thank you.
Yeah. So if no matter how I choose the colors of my coalgebra, or if no matter how I choose the colors of my deterministic automaton, following these two paths lands me on a state of the same color. I mean, what does that say about the two states that you arrive at?
Are they, I want to say they're bisimilar. I'm not sure.
So if it were up to bisimilarity, that, I mean, this is a very good guess, right? Because if it's that they're bisimilar, then that just says that they have the same behavior, or they have the same one color unravelings.
Well, so they are bisimilar up to commutativity of W and U, right?
So this is very close. Let me draw you a picture. If I so say that this coalgebra I've got, or this is my DFA. I've got A, and then let's go, let's call this B, and then this one is B, and this is A right here. If I unravel my DFA at this state, is there some way that I can color this DFA such that it doesn't satisfy the coequation?
I mean, if you color one of the two terminal states differently from the other, then you don't satisfy, right?
Yeah. So if I color this one blue and this one green, and then I unravel this tree, we'll be put in a situation where we don't have this. We'll be put in a situation where we have this instead. We've got blue here instead of green. It's not, we don't want that. So how would we fix that, I guess, in this automaton?
Yeah, if you color the initial state green, you're good to go.
And if I color with this state green right here?
Right, because of the tree relationship, unless the tree is structured elsewhere. Maybe I missed that.
So I'm kind of imagining that this tree is the unraveling of this automaton over here. Yeah. So it'll keep going.
In this particular automata, all you need to do is the two sink has the same color, right?
So I need it so that no matter what color I assign to the states down below, it has to end up such that these two states have the same color when you unravel the tree.
Oh, then basically they are the same state.
Yes, nice, absolutely. So this coalgebra down here does not satisfy the coequation, because if you do AB and then you do BA, you land on different states. So you could pick a coloring where you just color those states differently, right? So this coequation says says that if you take the path from x that follows the word w, it has to be equal to the state that you get from following the path u. So if you use colors, you can actually start talking about state equivalences, which is very cool. That's beyond behavior now. It's literal state equivalence. There's connections here to language theory. Like recognizing regular languages with finite monoids and stuff like that. But anyways, okay, I'm well over time now. Thank you so much for entertaining me at the end. And thank you for inviting me to talk to a new group of dirtbag graduate students.
Todd, this is so much fun. Thank you very much for talking to us. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
If people either who are watching now or who watch after the fact, which believe it or not, people actually do that. If they have questions, where can they reach you? Can they email you directly? What do you recommend?
Yeah, so I would email me at Todd Wayne Schmid at gmail.com. Don't use my UCL email. I had to dig it up to get the link and everything. But anyways, so I've put my email in the chat. I also have a website, which has a fun name.
Yeah, I'll link your website on ours with the talk, so people will be able to find it.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Thanks cool. Again, guys.
Hey, thank you, Todd. This is great. I really appreciate you. Have a great day.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.